There is this thing. Do you realize
what is there is this thing?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show, a part of CKUT's Off the Hour. Prison Radio has been on the air for more than 10 years. Prison Radio seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggle by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging our ideas about what are prisons and the people inside our jails. Prison Radio is dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. This is in the interest of forging stronger ties with incarcerated and non-incarcerated people, ensuring that prisoners have direct control over their representation and that our understanding of prisons be informed by those who live inside their walls. We invite anyone who is interested in collaborating on programming to contact us. Those who have been affected by the prison system in any way are encouraged to get involved. You can email news@ckut.ca or prison@ckut.ca, or you can call us at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. You are listening to CKUT, Montreal Community Campus Radio, located on 90.3 FM on the dial, and www.ckut.ca online.
Good morning. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is 11:03 a.m. My name is Virginia, and I'm your host for today's show. Today we'll be rebroadcasting the first episode of the Rust Belt Abolition Radio Project. We will then be joined live on the phone by Daniel McGowan to talk about the proposed visiting restrictions for prisoners in New York State's maximum security prisons. Later on in the program, we will speak to a member of the Prison Needle Syringe Program Nursing Coalition, a nationwide coalition of nurse associations who are advocating for clean needles and syringes to be made available in the federal prison system in Canada. As we often do, we will start today with some news. A news report by Amnesty International exposes the Syrian government's campaign of extrajudicial executions and by mass hangings at Saed Naya prison. Between 2011 and 2015, every week and often twice a week, groups of up to 50 people were taken out of their prison cells and hanged to death. In 5 years, as many as 13,000 people, most of them civilians believed to be opposed to the government, were hanged in secret at Saed Naya. The report is titled Human Slaughterhouse, Mass Hangings and Extermination in Saed Naya Prison. In addition to the mass killings, the report also shows that the government is deliberately inflicting inhuman conditions on detainees at Saed Naya Prison through repeated torture and the systemic deprivation of food, water, medicine, and medical care. The report documents how these extermination policies have killed mass numbers of people in prisons. Amnesty International says these practices amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. United States Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who, according to the New York Times, was denied a position as a federal judge in the 80s because a Republican majority Senate thought he was too racist, and whose appointment as Attorney General in the U.S. has been hailed as a win by white supremacists, has signaled his support for the federal government's continued use of private prisons in what would be a reversal of a decision the Obama administration made in the last 6 months. In a memo issued this week, Sessions told the Bureau of Prisons to return to its previous approach, which involved the use of private prisons. In related business news, GEO Group, one of the largest private prison corporations in the world, hailed U.S. President Donald Trump's newly announced immigration plans on a call with investors Wednesday and said that even more business could be on the way if a Republican congressional proposal to expand the incarceration of certain immigrants makes it into law. GEO Group is the largest provider of detention services to the three government agencies, that is, ICE, the Bureau of Prisons, and the U.S. Marshals Service. GEO Group isn't the only company celebrating the Trump immigration agenda. CoreCivic, the private prison firm formerly known as Corrections Corporation of America, announced on its earnings call earlier this month that the firm expects new business. Contractors that serve law enforcement also say they are expecting a flood of new border security contracts. Unisys, L3 Technologies, CACI International, and Motorola Solutions have mentioned in recent weeks that they view border security as a growth area. According to the alternative news website The Intercept, GEO Group was one of the first large publicly traded firms to make significant campaign contributions to the Trump election effort last year. The firm gave $50,000 to a pro-Trump super PAC and $45,000 to the Trump campaign via its joint fundraising committee with the Republican National Committee. CoreCivic also donated $250,000 to Trump's inauguration. Lawyers representing federal prisoners in Canada were in court earlier this month arguing that pay cuts made to federal prisoners' wages in 2013 were a violation of prisoners' charter rights. Rita Maglow-Francis, one of the lawyers representing federal prisoners, said that the cost of everyday items in prison has risen almost 725% since 1981, which was the year when wages for federal prisoners were set until they were lowered in 2013. Arguments for the case are finished now, and a decision from the judge is coming soon. We are now going to hear a short ad, and then we'll be having our first piece of the show.
MediaQueer.ca presents two free screenings at Concordia University in March. Join us on Saturday, March 4th at 2 p.m. for a rare screening of Clement Virgo's Rude, the first Black-directed and Black-starring feature film in Canada. Also, don't miss Dana Ingster's Welcome to Africville, a documentary about mid-century Black queer sexualities before demolition and gentrification. A co-presentation by Dawson College student group Legacy and Massimadi Montréal.
Then on Friday, March 10th at 6:30 p.m., Media Queer and the Mel Oppenheim School of Cinema are proud to present the Montreal premiere of This Is Gay Propaganda, LGBT Rights and the War in Ukraine by Marusia Borsukiv. Following the struggle of LGBTQ people after the Russian invasion of Donetsk in 2014, Borsukiv will discuss feminist and queer solidarity in Ukraine during the Q&A with CKUT's Tamara Filievich after the screening. Both events are free and will be held at Concordia University's Visual Arts Building, 1395 René Lévesque West, in Auditorium VA 114. For more information, go to www.mediaqueer.ca. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
This next piece is the first episode of the Rust Belt Abolition Radio Project, a radio project based in Detroit. The show is dedicated to the abolition of the carceral state and racial capitalism. The episode is entitled, What Do We Mean by Abolition?
Welcome to Rust Belt Abolition Radio. My name is Andres. Today we turn to recent news of the deepening impacts of the biggest prison strike in U.S. history, as we look at Kinross Correctional Facility in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. We also speak with Professor Liat Ben-Moshe on our carceral state and the political imaginary of abolition. We end today's show with a phone interview with Chaz, an imprisoned trans organizer in Michigan who is fighting for queer and trans prisoners' liberation.
I'm Kay Syed here with A. Maria, and you're listening to Rust Belt Abolition Radio, an abolitionist media and movement-building project based in Detroit, Michigan. In this show, we amplify the voices of those impacted by mass incarceration and explore ongoing work in our movement to abolish the carceral state. that is prisons, police, courts, as well as racial domination and capitalist exploitation.
Rust Belt Abolition Radio seeks to strengthen community collaboration and challenge the idea that putting people in cages and shackling them with electronic devices solves the problems produced by racial capitalism. Let's expand our ability to struggle against the ways in which the carceral state impacts our daily lives, and to create a space where we can both imagine and remake our world anew.
What does a world without prisons, police, and property look like? What kind of social relations are engendered when we solve our problems not by dialing the magic number, 911, but by resolving problems ourselves? These are the kinds of questions that abolitionists ask.
Prison abolition is not simply about finally letting go of an old form of solving problems, putting people in cages. Abolition also entails reshaping the ways in which we relate to one another in all scales. One of the ways Detroiters are working to relate together is through building community radio.
Community radio has the power to amplify social movements and counter the social death sentences imposed on our communities. It affirms that none of us are disposable and that the production of ideas in our homes and streets matters.
This radio project relies on a careful ear, an eagerness to learn and be challenged, and the ability to weave together a bigger picture for the benefit of listeners and those whose stories and struggles are being voiced. By providing a platform to share in-depth analysis informed by neighborhood expertise, Rust Belt Abolition Radio underpins self-determination and directly counters the narratives that stifle the needs and dreams of our communities. Now we turn to Alejo Stark, a co-producer of this show and the media spokesperson for Michigan Abolition and Prisoner Solidarity, MAPS. It's a statewide group organizing in solidarity with prisoners against the violence of incarceration and has propelled mainstream media coverage of the events of last fall's nationwide prison strike.
The September 9, 2016 prisoner uprising in the United States was the largest and most widespread rebellion organized by prisoners in U.S. history. The call to action was made by imprisoned organizers from the Free Alabama Movement in light of the anniversary of the Attica prison riots of September 9, 1971. On the outside, it was supported by organizers with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee of the IWW. However, the widespread character of the uprising demonstrates the widespread state of the crisis of mass incarceration. In the state of Michigan, as far as we know, only rebels imprisoned at the Kinross Correctional Facility joined in the nationwide September 9 uprising. Among many demands, the prisoners demanded higher wages. Laundry workers at Kinross, for instance, make only $20 a month. I spoke with Evelyn Summers, whose husband is incarcerated at Kinross, about the events of September 9.
My name is Evelyn Williams, and I am now the wife of Anthony Bates, and he's a prisoner at the Kinross Correctional Facility.
Can you tell us about a call that you made to your husband on September 9th of 2016?
You know, I was planning, that was my weekend, I was planning to go up. And he had told me, you know, kind of eighth, he had kind of told me what was going on and I might not be able to come. On the 9th, he called me. He's like, well, they let all the regular visitors and things come through, and so we should be okay. But he did tell me they had wouldn't feed them their normal food. It was only give them like a cheese sandwich and a banana for each one of the meals, or a cheese sandwich and three cookies and some milk for some of the meals, and they wasn't giving them their regular meals. And so a lot of them was getting upset about that because they should have been, you know, they got the food service should have been feeding them what the scheduled meal was. On Saturday the 10th, I was actually getting ready to go. I was actually waiting for the people to rent the car, people to come get me, you know, so I can go up there. He called me in a panic that morning, like 8:15, was like, don't come. The sirens is going off. They're about to lock us down. He couldn't talk to them home because the sirens was going off and it was making, you know, everybody go to their room and, you know, locking everything down. I didn't know what was going on. So it took a week almost before I ever talked to him again. He couldn't get through the phone. He couldn't get through even to talk to an officer there. The lines just said, we're upon an immobilization. Try your call again. And that happened almost for a week. I'm just looking at Facebook and I'm seeing different posts from the Free Press and people talking about what was going on and what happened. I don't know if they were able to hear from somebody who maybe had a contraband phone or something like that. But there's people putting reports that was scaring the death out of me because I didn't know what was going on.
So you didn't hear about your husband for a full week. You called, you heard the sirens, and you had no idea what was going on.
Not at all. All I'm hearing is the media reports and what I'm seeing on Facebook. All you hear is the damage where you know where your loved one is. You know, you hear about all the EFT agents, things going in.
The emergency response team, yeah.
but you don't know if they're okay. You don't know what's going on.
What did you find out afterwards about what had happened? You know, you told us you heard about the sirens this Saturday morning and the emergency response team from Paul Egan's article. What did you find out about what happened afterwards?
When he was finally able to call me, which was that following Thursday or Friday, and he called at like 10:15 in the morning, as soon as they let the, you know, the lockdown off. And he just told me everything that happened about the zip tie-in, the gentleman, about the guys. They tried to peaceably talk to the ward. The ward had come out and kind of promised them that they would supply some of their demands, take care of everything that they were asking. And the things that he couldn't, they would go to legislation about. You know, he said everybody walked away peaceful and fine. He said the warden stepped out the yard, shut the door. The guys went about their regular day thinking everything was okay, that they had just came to a common solution. He said, before you know it, here all these police and tactical guys coming in, zip-tying them, pulling guys out the shower, firing pepper spray. The guys in the very back unit, I guess the one that had the most damage, they tried to barricade themselves in, and the guys broke through there. You know, the police officers and things broke through there. He said all the regular unit police, they just all disappeared off the unit, just out of nowhere. They just all started leaving their posts. He said he knew something was kind of wrong. And then all these armed guards with shotguns came in there. And some of the guys had to sit out in the rain. Some of them hadn't had to use the bathroom on themselves, zip-tied outside for 5 or 6 hours.
So even though prisoners at Kinross met with the warden and seemed to have gotten to an agreement, you're saying they were still, as they went back peacefully, they were repressed by the emergency response team and zipped out, as you're saying, and left out in the cold. What do you think about all this? What do you think about this repression?
Well, I think it is wrong, of course. I think the guys, that no time, even when they were marching around the yard that morning, he said it was a peaceful demonstration. And even if you look at the reports, the real reports, everything said the guys were just walking around. They wasn't causing no disturbance. They just wanted to see the warden. The warden came. You know, all they wanted to do was get a couple of things that were against policy changed. It was nothing, and it's a force to dehumanize these men. Because even one gentleman I keep in contact with as well that was moved out, he did nothing. He had no part of this, and they moved him to a level 5, you know, maximum security prison for no reason. And now when they try to fight the ticket or fight a grievance, they always lose. You know, it's another way to repress and dehumanize these men.
And you've got a chance to talk with your husband about this afterwards, right? What does he think about the situation and process of dehumanization of prisoners, as you call it?
He's living it every day. You know, he always talks about it being the modern-day slavery. A lot of them don't have families. You know, they can't even afford soap and basic things. And then a lot of them come from the inner city. And so it's an even harder burden on their families to have to go through them and support them and things like that. And it makes somebody who already is serving sentences, it does not prepare them to come back for the world. I think that's what his biggest problem is. They don't do anything to prepare them to come back. So they're always left at a disadvantage. Even ones who come home and get out are left at a disadvantage. So now the society looks at them as a criminal. They can't get a job. They're in there with no education, no programs, no anything, and no pay. And it ends up being a revolving door because now to kind of make money or make things happen, they come back out here and they get into the same lifestyle because a system that's meant to rehabilitate them has failed them.
Well, thank you so much for your words, Evelyn. In more recent news, we have heard that retaliation against organizers and others involved in the Kinross uprising is much worse than is publicly well known. There are almost 200 prisoners that are staying in the hole, that is, in solitary confinement, for up to a year. We stand in solidarity with all those struggling against the brutality of imprisonment and want to emphasize that rebellions did not start on September 9. In fact, in March and April of 2016, rebels in 3 Michigan facilities demonstrated the great maxim of the Haitian Revolution: unity makes strength, by staging hunger strikes in those facilities. Nothing changed between March and September, and nothing has changed since September, except that prisoners are now better organized to struggle against the walls and cages that imprison them. As such, we think that the rebellions will and should continue.
Now we speak with Professor Liat Ben-Moshe about our carceral society and the political imaginary of abolition. But first, a brief clip from Dr. Ruth Wilson Gilmore on what she means by abolition.
Dr. Ruth Wilson Gilmore is director of the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics and professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the Graduate Center CUNY. She is a co-founder of many social justice organizations, including California Prison Moratorium Project, Critical Resistance, and the Central California Environmental Justice Network. In her book, Golden Gulag, Prisons, Surplus, Crisis, and Opposition in Globalizing California, she examined how political and economic forces produce California's prison boom. We open the segment with a recording of Dr. Gilmore's presentation on prison abolition, courtesy of the Connecticut Coalition to Oppose Indefinite Detention.
All right, I am an abolitionist. Abolition. Abolition is a plot against racial capitalism, which is all capitalism, not just some of it. It is a plot in a narrative sense. It is a plot in which the arc of change is always going resolutely toward freedom. It is a plot in a geographic sense. It is a plot in which we aim to make all space, not just some space, free in two senses. Free in the sense that it cannot be alienated, which is to say sold by anybody to anybody, and free in the sense of non-exclusive. There is no boundary or border that would keep somebody in or keep somebody out. That is abolition. That's the plot. That's my plot. It is an internationalist impulse that is part of what many of us call the Black radical tradition, which is open for all.
If the aim of abolition is to make all space free and non-exclusive, with no boundary or border that would keep somebody in or keep somebody out, how do we reconcile that with the impulse to move people out of prisons and into mental health facilities? Dr. Liat Ben-Moshe is Assistant Professor of Disability Studies at the University of Toledo and a scholar activist who works in the intersection of prison abolition, anti-psychiatry, deinstitutionalization, and disability justice. She is co-editor of Disability Incarcerated, Imprisonment and Disability in the United States and Canada. I spoke with Dr. Ben-Moshe about the abolitionary mindset and asked, what does this mindset lead us to question?
What an abolitionary mindset on prison really does is that it leads us to question really deep, profound question around, you know, what do we call innocence? What is harm? What do we do when people harm us? What is safety? Why do we feel safe? Who's the we, right? Why do we feel safe under certain conditions and not others? And again, I'm really saying who's the we, I think, is one of the profound questions here too. Who's not the we? And what are the consequences of that erasure and exclusion? It's about vulnerability. It's about care. It's about like so many different questions. So it's really not what people think. I think about prison abolition is that it's about closing prisons. It really crystallizes for us the society in which we live in, the values that it has, and the kind of alternative structures that we want to put in place.
Do you think we can wait for abolition? And how do you respond to the critiques that people lay on an abolitionary mindset?
I started to think recently more broadly about the abolitionary mindset through really the lens of not just prison abolition, but, you know, we can talk about the abolition of slavery as well. But from my work also on deinstitutionalization, and that taught me a lot of different lessons around the critiques that people lay on an abolitionary mindset. So if we take prison abolition as an example, and this is word for word what was said about deinstitutionalization, and a lot of it, a little bit less word for word, around an abolition of slavery, is that people said it's not realistic in the current society that we live in. Like, this might work really well in like Norway or something, but they didn't say that about slavery, but about prisons and institutions, that it's not, the conditions are not ripe right now. So maybe, you know, we need to wait a little bit. And people did say that about slavery as well. It's a good idea, right? It's kind of an ethical idea that's, we can think about, but not right now. Like, it's not, there's not like alternatives in place. people are not ready. People often say about abolition is that it's only a critique, that it's not prescriptive, doesn't offer us anything, that it doesn't give us like specific solutions as to what to do. It only critiques what we have right now. And so what I want to say is that this is the beauty of abolition, is all those things. These are not really critiques, because the beauty of abolition to me is that it is an ethical position. And it's an ethical position in which the time is always ripe for. We cannot wait. I mean, slaves couldn't wait, right, till the time is right. People who are rotting in institutions and prisons. And when I say institution, by the way, I mean mostly these kind of large-scale residential institutions for people with intellectual disabilities. People couldn't wait for the right time to do that. And unfortunately, people did die in these places while waiting for us to do something. And it took a really long time to get rid of kind of that mindset that people with disabilities need to be in these facilities. And even though right now in the U.S., I mean, there are still a lot of states that have these large-scale institutions for people with intellectual disabilities and psychiatric hospitals, most states in the U.S. do not. And there's about 13 states in the U.S. right now that don't have any residential institutions that are large-scale, you know, so over 16 people or people with intellectual disabilities. So what happened? We don't have people with disabilities? I mean, no, that's not what happened. We just decided that as a society, as a policy, as a culture, we rid ourselves of this as an option. Like, this is not an option. And so if it's not an option, what do we do? And that, lo and behold, opens so many opportunities, because the idea that it wasn't prescriptive, I mean, it's true. People didn't know what to do. I mean, there were some experts who said, you know, this might work, this might work. But ultimately, things can only work when you try them out. And you can try them out if all the money and all the efforts go into reforming institutions, building more institutions, making them better, putting more people in them, and so on. Once we got rid of that, we found out a lot of other ways of relating to people. Now, not all of it is successful. Not all of it will be successful. And it's not successful also for different people, right? But on the ground, we could never find these things if we're so committed to other projects of incarceration. And so it really is an either-or kind of situation. So not being prescriptive is actually really useful for an abolitionary praxis. Not being realistic, I think, is also something that's said a lot about abolition. Like, you're not realistic. Like, it's great. I'm with you all the way, right? As an ethical stance, abolition is wonderful. But, you know, it's not realistic. Of course, that's also not true, because prison is not realistic. It's absolutely not a realistic project. And I think people from the right and the left are starting to critique it for very, very different reasons, but especially because of that it's absolutely not a sustainable project. And so I think our ideas of what is realistic or not are really tainted by the kind of goals that we have. And I think for abolitionists, when we see liberation, you know, as the goal, and we see a completely different structure of society as the goal, that we're not confined by these kind of critiques. We actually see them as opportunities to make something.
Let's talk about the logics of incarceration. Where does incarceration take place, and why is that important?
Incarceration happens not just in spaces behind bars. So, for instance, and we know this for a lot of people with disabilities, especially intellectual and psychiatric disabilities, so the kind of more, let's say, invisible, perhaps, forms of disabilities, their forms of incarceration is usually in things like nursing homes or institutions or psych wards, places that we don't often think about as carceral spaces, but they're incarcerated there nonetheless. And so if we only think about prisons, we don't think about those spaces. And the reason why it's important, especially for activism, is because then when we talk about, oh, we really need to abolish or even reform prison spaces, we often think about things like, oh, what we can do is open psych wards or make sure that people are not in prison, but maybe they're in nursing homes. And what people with disabilities are telling us is that they see themselves as incarcerated in those spaces. So those are not in any way progressive moves on our part to get rid of one space and then open another space that's just as carceral or encased in carceral logics.
You take seriously the notion of the carceral archipelago presented by French social theorist Michel Foucault. This concept encourages us to consider the control of public space and the disciplining of society through means such as surveillance and checkpoints, and illuminates why it's important to think about the carceral rather than just the prison when advancing abolition.
I think the other thing that's really important is that it moves us from thinking about things with walls to more thinking about the logics of incarceration. So what does it mean to live in a carceral state? And that's not just those people that are over there behind bars. And I think thinking about the carceral archipelago and carceral logics really frees us from those binaries, so that it's not just those people that we're trying to free, you know, kind of like a savior complex, but it's really about what is my role within a carceral state? How am I embedded within the prison industrial complex, for example, but other carceral sites?
Now, we turn to the struggle of those who are queer and trans and incarcerated at the G. Robert Cotton Correctional Facility in Jackson, Michigan, where they are routinely sexually harassed and demeaned by correctional officers. Sexual harassment of prisoners is a violation of the Federal Prison Rape Elimination Act. When some of the prisoners filed grievances against officers for the illegal behavior, they experienced further mistreatment and retaliation, with officers ganging up against them in coordinated efforts to retaliate against the grievances. "We may be caged, but we're not animals," said trans inmate Chaz. Chaz was an activist inside the Jackson facility until being recently transferred to Carson City, Michigan. A former nurse, she hopes to be a public speaker when she's released. We talked with her about what it's like to be a trans activist on the inside.
"This call is from a correction facility and is subject to monitoring and recording. Thank you for using GTL.
We are caged, but we are not animals. Being an activist in prison, it enriches me. You know, it empowers me. It makes me feel like I'm not alone and I have a voice, especially when you meet other activists on the inside and outside that will fight for you, and not just that, but fight with you. That's mostly important because for so many years I felt like I was just alone, like I didn't have that voice, wasn't nobody listening, wasn't nobody willing to fight. You know, like everybody here, I'm tough, I'm a gangbanger, I'm this, but ain't nobody willing to go for the whole fight. I take a stand. And I just refuse to lay down. You know, so being an activist for me has made me more self-confident. It has healed a lot of my past wounds and hurts. So it made me focused on what's important. So being an activist, for me, Jimmy, on the inside, has been really amazing because it makes me feel like I'm still a human being and that I have a purpose for life."
In the spirit of liberation and abolition, this week we commemorate the anniversary of the Haitian Revolution, the most successful slave uprising in history. The slaves of Saint-Dumont, now Haiti, rose up against their French masters, expelling them from the island and striking a blow against slavery, colonialism, imperialism, and racial capitalism. As Afro-Trinidadian Marxist intellectual and socialist militant C.L.R. James wrote in his History of the Haitian Revolution, titled The Black Jacobins, quote, "In 1789, the French bourgeoisie was the most powerful economic force in France, and the slave trade and the colonies were the basis of its wealth and power," end quote. C.L.R. James thereby ties capitalist accumulation and slavery as interlocking and overlapping modes of production, and demonstrating that capitalism was always already racial. In other words, the economic success of the French bourgeoisie was founded on the exploitation of the black workers in Saint-Dumont. As such, the struggle for the abolition of slavery, for human liberation, is also the struggle for the abolition of capitalism. It is in this way that we invoke the long history and the spirit of abolition and call forth the words of C.L.R. James in The Black Jacobins: "The rich are only defeated when running for their lives." Today, the struggle toward an abolitionist future, for a world without capitalist exploitation and racial domination, a world without prisons, private property, and police continues.
Thanks for tuning in. Check out our website at www.rustbeltradio.org. This show was co-produced by the Rust Belt Abolition Radio team, Andres, A. Maria, Abe Syed, and Alejo Stark.
That was the first episode of Rust Belt Abolition Radio, which is based out of Detroit, Michigan. To find out more or to listen to the second episode of their podcast, which is now up online, you can go to rustbeltradio.org. The time is presently 11:35. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. We are now joined live on the phone by Daniel McGowan. Daniel is an environmental and social justice activist from Queens, New York. He was arrested in 2005 with 15 counts of arson, property destruction, and conspiracy, all related to two actions in Oregon in 2000, which were claimed by the Earth Liberation Front. Daniel was facing a minimum of life in prison if convicted when he accepted a non-cooperation plea agreement. He received a 7-year sentence and did most of it in two communication management units. His arrest was part of what the U.S. government dubbed Operation Backfire, a coordinated multi-state sweep of over 15 activists by the federal government who charged the individuals with practically every earth and animal liberation action in the Pacific Northwest's left unsolved. Many have considered this roundup indicative of the government's Green Scare focus, which had activists being arrested and threatened with life in prison. Many of the charges, including Daniel's, were for crimes whose statute of limitations were about to expire. Daniel was released from prison in December 2012 and was on probation for 3 years until June 2016. He has worked with the New York City Anarchist Black Cross, the Civil Liberties Defense Center, and the National Lawyers Guild Parole Preparation Project and Political Prisoners Committees. Daniel is on the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners Calendar Collective. We will be talking to Daniel about recent changes proposed by New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo to the visiting system in maximum security prisons in New York State. Hi, Daniel. Can you hear me?
Yes, I sure can. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for coming. So a few weeks ago, Governor of New York State Andrew Cuomo proposed cutting the visiting hours in maximum security prisons in New York. Can you tell us more about the proposal and what the current situation is with visiting hours in maximum security prisons in New York State?
Sure. Like you said, a few weeks ago, Andrew Cuomo, the New York State governor, proposed a plan to reduce visiting at the state's maximum security prisons from the current situation, which is 7 days of available visiting, to 3 days a week. It pretty much affects around 21,000 people that are in the New York State prison population of 54,000, and it's about 18 different prisons. And so the governor, as usual, speaks out of both sides of his mouth. His stated reason was he wanted to align the visiting policy of maximums with mediums, which currently have, are only available 3 days a week, and create video visitation. But the reality is that he has already hinted to some of the state politicians that it's really about saving money. And the amount of money we're talking about is on the state level, relatively small, is $2.6 million. And curiously, it involves eliminating 39 jobs. And for whatever reason, the police union, NYSCOBA, hasn't beefed up about this, which is strange because they're very concerned about protecting their jobs. And, considering that the visit room job is a very cush one, it just involves sitting there and taking IDs. Curious to me why they haven't said anything. It might be based on their, their overall scorn for prisoners in general. But so that's currently where we're at. It was done through the budget proposal, and I imagine there's going to be these kind of hyper corrupt backroom budget deals going on for the next month. I think it finishes in April.
Okay. In a petition that is circulating on change.org, it says, quote, "While in other contexts the governor claims to want to support compassionate policies and reduce mass incarceration, his visit reduction policy will seriously escalate suffering and family disruption, as well as have a negative impact on prison safety and people's success upon release. You talked a little bit about this in your answer to the first question, but can you talk a bit more about the context in which this proposal is happening?
Sure. Well, there's two particular contexts that I think are important. One is, if all you read or paid attention to was what the governor says, you would think that we live in New York State in a progressive state, and that these institutions of incarceration are run in this orderly and humane way. But the reality is that Cuomo just spits out progressive talk, but the situation upstate on many levels remains the same. At the same time that he is talking about compassion and reducing mass incarceration, what you find is a tremendous outbreak of violence in upstate prisons. And the violence that I speak about is not prisoner-on-prisoner violence. It's staff-on-prisoner violence. The last couple of years, you can read, there's a lot of articles about particular incidents that took place at Attica and Clinton involving violence from staff. You even had a situation in which three COs were indicted for assault and allowed to plead out to a misdemeanor charge. So you have that. You also have the New York Times exposing systemic racial discrimination, not only in parole, but in how discipline works in upstate prisons, how a black or brown prisoner has a much more likely chance of getting found guilty of incident reports than a white prisoner and faces more sanctions and time. Parole for basically the so-called A1 violent offenders, which is a lot of the people that are at maximums, is not even 20%. And so you have people like Jaleel Muntakim, who's a political prisoner that's currently held in a SHU called Southport, a solitary confinement wing, has gone to the parole board for 9 times. It's not uncommon for people who have been in prison in New York State 9 times, or for like 40, 45 years, and face tremendous parole denials, like 9, 10, 11, or 12. So you have this situation where the governor talks a really good game. He talks about compassion and yet isn't really doing anything on the concept of compassionate release, medical parole, or even clemency. He, after 2.5 years of being pressured, he finally gave 12 clemencies out to individuals, which allowed 2 people to go to the parole board right away, and it released about 7 people to the streets. But that's, I mean, when you look at the numbers, and it's really frustrating because you're talking about 54,000 people in the system, and there's a lot more candidates than 12 individuals. So that is one context, is just the doublespeak of Andrew Cuomo. The other context is that in the wake of the escape from Clinton last year or 2 years ago, there's been this kind of collective punishment doled out to New York State prisoners. In some ways, it's all been very petty. They banned hoodies, like hooded sweatshirts, last year. There's moves to reduce or get rid of the so-called trailer visit, which is the family visitation program where a prisoner could have their family come in. They get locked into a trailer with a TV and food, and they hang out with their family all weekend, as well as reducing the use of honor blocks, which are blocks mostly for people that have clean records, clean disciplinary records inside, and elder prisoners, of which there are at least, I think, 10,000 to 12,000 elder prisoners in the New York State system. So this is happening sort of in this wave of blowback from the escape, and in direct contrast to Andrew Cuomo's progressive chatter.
Okay. Folks are fighting the proposal with this change.org petition, and there's also a call and letter writing campaign that's included in the petition, where folks are being asked to call Cuomo and tell him to withdraw the proposal and instead take steps to further expand access for people to visit their loved ones in prison. Do you want to share with our listeners how they can contribute to the struggle to stop this from happening?
Sure. Well, currently, I would say the easiest way to do the easiest way to chime in on this, and it's the way that anyone around the world or could do that, is definitely sign the petition. It's on change.org. It's called "Don't Restrict Visits in New York State Prisons." It's pretty easy to find if you just search on change.org. It currently has 2,381 names, but I would definitely recommend, especially for New Yorkers, in particular for New York State people, that they find out who their assembly person and state senator is and write those people or call those individuals, especially as budget time gets closer. The other thing is that there's a kind of longer action alert that exists that has a number of different individuals that people can email. You can find that action alert on nycabc.wordpress.com. Again, that's nycabc.wordpress.com. That's the New York City Anarchist Black Cross website. Or if you're on Twitter, you can find it on @certaindays or @thetinyraccoon. And as well as Facebook, the Certain Days Facebook profile is pretty easy to find. There's a number of individuals in that action alert that you can write. You also made a good point about further expanding access. And I think that in times of blowback, whether it's like nationally in the states or in any other context, it's important to not just fight their horrible proposals, but to sort of keep on the offensive. And so there are definitely, in your communications with these individuals, I think it's important to, you know, to say that not only do we need to get rid of this proposal from Andrew Cuomo, but to really expand Prison Days at medium and minimum security prisons to get those back. Because in reality, and I didn't talk about this, but the proposal to limit it to 3 days a week is going to create a tremendous amount of misery for people incarcerated as well as their family members when they show up after being on a bus for 7 hours and find out that there's no room in the visiting room and their visits will be terminated. Or to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to a prison and then find out that when they get there, they have to wait for 3 hours. I've gone to prison visits at Attica and Wendy, as well as Fishkill, further closer to New York City. And the process is laborious and really cumbersome. It takes forever. And it really just makes for misery of the people who are visiting their families. I think the other two things that, in terms of keeping on the offensive, we need to restore the free bus transportation to prison facilities. There used to be a bus that was funded by New York State dollars that basically left from New York City because there were so many people incarcerated from New York City in upstate prisons, and it basically went to a bunch of different prisons. That was something that was cut, in the budget 5 years ago. There's also the idea of expanding the family reunification program, the trailer visits that I spoke about. Those are sort of really hard to get into and limited, and in reality, the prisons could do a tremendous amount more in expanding them so that people have access to really solid visits with their families, which definitely bodes well for their release chances in terms of getting their plans for release together, as well as, making prison like slightly less miserable than it already is for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming on air, Daniel. It's been really great to get these updates. And folks looking for more information, do you want to just repeat those websites really quickly?
Yeah, sure. Like I said, the action alert you can find online. It's at nycabc.wordpress.com. You can find the Certain Days profile on Facebook. Or on Twitter, it's @CertainDays. And there's a lot of organizations in New York State that are fighting this, but it doesn't appear to be an issue that's in anyone's direct purview. So it's sort of up to everyone that has family inside and friends inside to fight this. And finally, I just want to give a shout-out. I understand that some prisons get this show, and I wanted to just shout-out to David at Wendy, Seth at Sullivan, Herman at Great Meadow, and Jaleel at Southport.
Okay. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thanks.
That was Daniel McGowan, an environmental and social justice activist from Queens, New York, who spent 7 years in prison. Daniel's on the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners Calendar Collective. Three other members of the Calendar Collective are currently incarcerated political prisoners who would be affected by the changes to the visiting regime in New York State prisons should it come into effect. We'll end our show today with an interview with a member of the Prison Needle Syringe Program Nursing Coalition, a nationwide coalition of nurse associations who are advocating for clean needles and syringes to be made available in federal prisons. The Prison Needle Syringe Program Nursing Coalition is involved in a lawsuit before the Superior Court of Ontario for clean needles and syringes to be made available in federal prisons. The lawsuit was filed by 4 HIV/AIDS agencies and a former prisoner who contracted hepatitis C during his incarceration. The lawsuit challenges the constitutionality of the decision to treat clean needles and syringes as contraband. Lisa, who we're speaking with, is a registered nurse and policy advisor with the Canadian Nurses Association. She discusses the role of nurses in instituting harm reduction strategies inside federal prisons.
Lisa, Thank you so much for joining us here on the Prison Radio Show. Please introduce yourself. Who are you? And what is your relationship to the Prison Needle Syringe Program Nursing Coalition?
Well, thank you very much. My name is Lisa Ashley. I'm a registered nurse, and I am a senior nursing advisor working on policy at the Canadian Nurses Association. A lot of the work we do at the Canadian Nurses Association, or CNA as I'll call it for the rest of this call, is around harm reduction and ensuring that we're putting in place programs that look after the dignity for people, no matter where they live, and ensuring harm reduction services are there. CNA is part of this coalition. And we created this coalition with the Association of Registered Nurses of British Columbia, the Canadian Association of Nurses of HIV/AIDS Care, and the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario to challenge the lawsuit on its constitutionality of the decision to treat clean needles and syringes as contraband, and seek an order that would bring clean needle exchange programs to federal prisons. I can't really speak any more about the case because it is with the lawyers now. But the reason we created this coalition is because a number of years ago, as you know, we actually, these four nursing associations worked together to ensure that the INSIGHT program was put in place in British Columbia. And so that's the history of how we came together.
Yes, there are currently clean needle and syringe programs in many cities, such as INSIGHT in Vancouver, but so far the programs are inaccessible in prisons. And what would a harm reduction strategy in prisons look like?
So nurses are actually, we have hundreds of nurses already working in corrections across the country. But what you're doing in prisons is ensuring that programs that are out in the communities, and we know with this new government that they've also approved three safe injection sites for people in Montreal, it's ensuring that Canadians that are in prisons receive that same type of service so that they're receiving clean needles and clean syringes rather than using contraband that we know gets into prisons so that we have a reduction in HIV and hepatitis C. And we know that these types of programs have actually made that type of improvements in people's health and wellness.
I feel like prisoners have been advocating for hep C and HIV programs in prisons for a long time. Do you feel like there are any contextual events that make this court case in particular timely in 2017?
Well, certainly I think we have a government, as you know, that is moving towards this approach, different than our previous government. And so we're in a climate where we can actually start to advocate for these. And we know that Corrections Services Canada is open to this, and they're just trying to make sure that it's put in place in as safe a way as possible for the prison, the inmates, as well as everybody who works in the prisons. Which is why when you think of the INSIGHT program in British Columbia, and I had the opportunity to visit there, it's set up in a very safe environment where people self-select to come in, and that's the type of program we would want to see in the prison as well, where prisoners are not forced to come in, but they can come into a safe environment, be provided with clean equipment, clean syringes, and clean needles, and have nurses nearby to be there to ensure that they don't overdose when they're sitting there injecting, when that they can have a conversation about their health. And so it provides a very safe, non-judgmental environment for people.
What do you feel would be some of the longer-term positive impacts of a harm reduction strategy in prisons, in federal prisons in Canada?
Well, certainly we know from research that the rates of that 80% of Canadians incarcerated deal with severe drug or alcohol addiction. We know that the rates of HIV are 10 times higher in correctional facilities than in the general population, And we know that hepatitis C is 30 to 39 times higher in correctional facilities than in the general population. So harm reduction measures such as prison needle syringe programs are crucial to address that addiction and those communicable diseases, and they've been shown around the world to dramatically decrease the spread of HIV and other infections. So we know this. It also has shown to reduce needle sharing, and in the prison population, it has been shown to ensure that people then are using clean paraphernalia. It has been shown to not lead to increased drug use or injecting. So if someone's actually interested and ready, and nurses would be able to recognize this through conversations, be ready to work on reducing their drug use, that has been shown to do that. It reduces drug overdoses because you have nurses nearby who are watching someone inject. It's also increased the use of referrals to drug treatment programs. We found that as well. And it's not resulted in needles or syringes being used as weapons against staff. The research shows that as well around the world. It's really been very effective in a wide range of institutions and has been effectively employed to reduce needle distribution and to increase that counseling, that therapeutic relationship that can be developed between the nurse and the inmate. So there's certainly, it's been shown to be very positive and can help people to take that step in an environment because it adds that extra time when someone's in with the nurse to have that conversation that may not occur at another time. If they're coming in for a wound or something else. I mean, there are certainly times when nurses in corrections they're always having relationships, doing health care with the inmates, but this provides that extra opportunity to really focus on having those conversations around this harmful behavior. And they're doing it in a way that ensures the dignity of the inmate that they're working with.
How would you argue that this is a public health issue and not just something that should be addressed within the narrow framework of prison policy, basically?
Okay, certainly. Well, it is a public health, you're talking to a past community health nurse here who worked in public health for years, and ensuring public health and public safety is integral to anything that nursing does in the country, that nurses are always looking at that broader perspective of ensuring, and this is an important public health issue because it helps to reduce the spread of HIV infection and reduce AIDS, reduce hepatitis C, and increases the recognition that prisons are appropriate environments to have these types of programs.
Since you've been involved in this legal process, what have the types of responses been? Do you feel hopeful about the outcome of the legal proceedings?
Well, I can't speak about the legal proceedings, but certainly we're doing a lot to educate nurses and other health professionals around the country as well. We're actually going to be hosting a 5-series webinar from March through till May with nurse experts from across the country, and these will be in English and French, that will talk about these issues. They'll talk about substance use, the opioid issue, and weaving a harm reduction focus or thread throughout all of these. What the message we're trying to put out there is that, and nurses learn this when they're in schools, is that you have an ethical responsibility to provide non-judgmental care to individuals, and this includes individuals that are harmed by illegal drug use regardless of the setting that they're in. It's really, we really are going to be emphasizing the human rights issue of this and the importance of treating all individuals with respect and dignity, irrespective of drug use.
Lisa, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for joining us here on the Prison Radio Show on CKUT. Do you have any final thoughts or comments you would like to share with our listeners?
I think it's very important for everyone and your McGill listening population, and I'm from Montreal, your McGill listening population to really understand the role of nurses within all this. And as we're able to share more about the legal proceedings, we will be putting it up on our website.
That was Lisa from the Canadian Nurses Association speaking about harm reduction strategies in federal prisons from a nursing perspective. This is it for the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. Our next show is happening on March 9th at 5 p.m. That's a Thursday. And we're going to hand it over to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts. Okay, so you got something.